Nothing comes from nothing. That was an even better sign. He'd only been speaking Kapalah for the last 7 months. Come sit with me on the patio while I drink my coffee and regale me with your Latin witticisms. The old man smiled, the crow's feet narrowing around his dancing eyes. Delighted. They sat on the patio overlooking the city. The sun glinted silver on the gray-blue Mediterranean. Brosa laid back in her chaise lounge, her eyes closed, enjoying the warmth of a gentle sunshine. Her father sat upright in a chair next to her, humming an old tune. She was still exhausted, but supremely happy. Perhaps he was turning a corner after all. Peña was right, she decided. The Brigada case was closed. It was time to let go. Her momentary bliss was shattered by the buzz of her silenced phone. Her eyes opened, painfully, as she searched for it. I hate those things, her father said. Let me throw it away. It's probably work. I hate your work. I should throw that away, too. She smiled and shook her head. Somebody has to pay the bills around here. She could never say that to him, though. He was a proud man, and a good provider for his family, while he could work. It will just be a moment. She saw the number. Part of her wanted to ignore the call, but part of her wanted to hear his voice. She didn't know why. Hola, Jack. Hi, sorry to bother you. I was hoping we could talk. Sure, I have a few minutes. I mean, I want to meet you somewhere. She glanced over at her father, who was staring at the distant sea, pretending not to listen. She lowered her voice. Why can't we speak on the phone? I'm not sure it's safe. Are you serious? Yes. I checked at your office, but they said you had left for the day.
I'm not feeling well.
I'm sorry. I wouldn't ask if it wasn't important.
She sighed.
She really wasn't feeling well, and she didn't want to leave her father. But Jack needed closure, too. It would be nice to be the one to deliver the good news in person. Okay. I'll text you an address, and I'll see you there in 30 minutes. Thanks. He hung up. Who is Jack? Her father asked. An American. She texted the address of her restaurant. I've been trying to help him. She hit the send key. What is his full name?
Jack Ryan.
Ryan? His eyes widened. You can't trust this man. Brosa frowned. Why not? Ernesto leaned over, wagging a finger. Because he is a spy.
Brosa's heart sank. So much for turning a corner.
She sat up.
And why do you think he is a spy?
Because I worked with him when he was in Brussels, at NATO headquarters. I was a translator there with the Spanish Defense Ministry.
She patted his spotted hand. I don't think Jack was old enough to work with you in Brussels. In fact, he wasn't even born yet.
His face fell.
You don't believe me.
She stood, picking up her empty coffee cup. He rose on unsteady knees as well.
Yes, of course I do. I believe you believe it. But perhaps it is just a coincidence of names.
Is he handsome?
Brosa pursed her lips, thinking.
She didn't want to feed his fantasy, but she could never lie to her father.
Yes.
And he is young, about your age.
Yes.
And does he have blue eyes?
How would he know that?
Well, he couldn't. It was just another crazy coincidence. She hated to confirm that fact to him because it would feed his dementia, convincing him he didn't have it. But a good daughter never lies to her father, does she?
Yes.
Jack does have blue eyes.
You see, it's him. Un espía!
His eyes beamed with pride. She touched a hand to his bearded face. She smiled outwardly, but inwardly wept with pity.
Thank you, Papa. That is good to know. I promise I will be very, very careful with this espía.
I have my pistol,
I'll get it for you. He turned toward the house, but she stopped him with a gentle tug on his elbow. No need. He isn't dangerous. And besides, I carry my own, remember? Of course I remember. I'm the one who taught you how to shoot when you were just a little girl. And you taught me well. I won't be gone long. Perhaps an hour, no more than two. I will call the nurse. Nonsense. I have my football. Barca plays Granada today. I'll wait here by the television for you. She hugged him. He wrapped his long arms around her. I love you, Papa. I love you, too. Stay safe. I will. Always.
Chapter 50 Jack and Brosa sat at one of the window-side tables near the entrance to Els Quatre Gats, the Four Cats, in Bari Gothic, waiting for the server to bring their coffees and bombas.
Do you know the history of this place? Brosa asked.
Picasso displayed his first painting here at 17. The original owner discovered many other great artists. You could call it the birthplace of modernism.
I didn't know you were an art scholar.
Jack shrugged. Well, I read it on the menu. She glanced around at the stained glass windows, brass fixtures, and period artwork.
It can be touristy at times, but when it's quiet like this, I find it quite charming. Very fin de siècle. Something old and yet something new. It is very Catalonian.
Thanks for suggesting it. And thanks for coming down. How's your father?
He's home, watching soccer. He's a hometown fan, of course. Thank you for asking.
You said you have good news for me.
Brosa sat up, beaming. You saw the news yesterday about Brigada?
Yeah. All killed. Is it true?
Yes.
How can you be sure?
I was there.
You were the woman they showed charging that house before it blew.
Brosa lowered her eyes, embarrassed by the attention. Yes, I suppose so. I didn't see the actual broadcast.
Jack reached across the table and squeezed her hand.
Are you okay? Yes, of course. No big deal.
The newscast said they blew themselves up and tried to take you all with them.
That's exactly what happened. You should be happy.
Why?
Because those terrorists are all dead, and your friend has her justice.
Did you get my text with the photo?
The man with the hazel eyes?
Yes, of course.
Did you check the farmhouse?
Was he there?
We couldn't get through the wreckage. It was too extensive. It's still being dealt with. The bodies are at the coroner's office at the Guardia Civil and being identified. That will take some time. A week, perhaps two. The remains were scattered by the blast. If he's there, I will let you know.
I appreciate that. Brosa frowned.
I thought you'd be happy to know that the case is closed.
I am. I just hate loose ends. I'll be completely satisfied when the guy is found and identified.
Like I said, it will take some time.
The server arrived with their coffees and bombas.
Gracias, Jack said.
The college-age server smiled. She was cute and gave Jack another look as she walked away.
Brosa saw this. Jack didn't.
Well, your Catala is getting better, I see. She lifted her cup.
To Renee. May she rest in peace now.
To Renee. They sipped in silence for a moment. Brosa cut her bomba with a fork.
Do you know why they call this a bomba?
It means bomb, doesn't it? Jack really hadn't thought about it.
Yes. It was invented because of the Civil War. The round potato croquet is the bomb, and this little bit of garlic aioli cream on top is meant to be the fuse, and the hot red sauce is meant to be like an explosion in your mouth.
Jack cut his with a fork as well. The tine crunched through the lightly fried potato, revealing the ground beef interior. He suddenly wasn't sure if he wanted to eat it. Yeah, it was a piece of culinary history, and delicious as hell. But Renee. He set his fork down.
What if he wasn't at the farmhouse? Then I'll find him. I promise you that. You know I will. I won't feel like the case is closed until we find him. Her voice lowered. Until I find him. You need to go home. But do you want to get me in trouble? I've already brought you too deep into this case as a favor to you. Please don't put my job at risk. It means too much to me. I'm not trying to put your job. Brose's phone rang. It's my father. I need to take these. She snatched it up. Of course. She spoke with him in a calming tone for a few minutes, but Jack could hear the rising anxiety in her father's voice over the phone's earpiece. Jack couldn't understand what they were saying, but he could read the emotions. She rang off. Jack, I'm sorry, but I must go. My father, he's very upset, and he... You don't need to explain anything. Thank you. She reached for her purse. Forget it, it's on me. Jack pulled out his wallet as they stood and peeled off several bills, leaving enough for the food and an overly generous tip. Brose started to leave. He stopped her. Let me walk you to your car and say a proper goodbye. She nodded. Of course. Forgive my poor manners. Thank you. Let's go. They exited through the Gothic-styled archway and onto the narrow paved walkway, heading east on Carrera de Moncia. Hardly a street, save for the small delivery vans that navigated the pedestrian path. It was crowded with people, including some tourists, but mostly locals, Jack saw, many of them with their independence flags draped over their shoulders like capes, as he'd seen before. Another protest. We must hurry. My car is across Via Laietana. Jack knew the four-lane boulevard well. It was one of the main arteries in the old town. It had been the site of previous protests, judging by the melted street signs and burned trash cans that the city government hadn't yet replaced. The pedestrian walkway changed its name to Portet, where it widened into a two-lane thoroughfare, picking up more and more protesters as they went. A blue police van was parked at the end of it, fronting Laietana. Jack and Brose were carried by the flow of flag-draped bodies surging around the van and onto Laietana, which was now a river of humanity. The cars were completely stopped in all four lanes. Most drivers were smiling and pointing, and many honked their horns, all in support of the march. Signs called for liberty, freedom of speech, and justice for the jailed politicians. Not many called for independence, Jack noticed. He supposed the independence flags with the white stars were loud enough. These things happen so quickly, like a flash mob, Brose said, smiling. I'm so proud of my people. Do you see? No violence, only hope. Which way? Right, down to the traffic circle, left on Cambo. Jack took Brose's hand as well as the lead, guiding them both through the swelling masses. People were laughing and shouting and blowing whistles, too. Jack even heard a couple of trumpeting vuvuzelas, like at a soccer game. Jack was half a head taller than most and broader-shouldered, but he still felt suffocated by the boisterous crowds and the people bumping into him as they squeezed past. It wasn't possible for Brose to walk next to him. Bodies surged around them, propelling them forward, but trapping them as well. He felt her shifting back and forth at the end of his arm like she was a fish on the hook of his hand. Jack kept his head on a swivel, glancing left and right as they marched, glad to be holding her fingers in his, knowing she was right behind him. He felt a sudden pang of sadness, knowing that in a few moments he'd put her in her car and likely never see her again. If he stayed around for a while, he knew they'd be good friends. Who knows? Maybe even more. And she was right. It was her case. And she'd be the one to finally close it once she found Crooked Nose, dead or alive. He only wished he could be there when she did. What neither Jack nor Brose realized was that the hazel-eyed man with the crooked nose, Biekov, was very much alive, and only a few feet behind them. Jack! He barely heard Brose's voice above the din, but it broke sharply, like a cry. A second later, her hand released, and Jack instinctively grasped it harder, only to feel the sudden weight of her body pulling him backward. He turned around just as her body hit the pavement, her paralyzed arms unable to cushion her fall as her head thudded like a melon against the sidewalk. Byakov leaped over her body and lunged at Jack, thrusting a handheld jet injector like a rapier at Jack's bare throat. Jack let go of Brosa's hand as he lunged backward, bumping hard into a shorter, broad-backed Spaniard, built like a stevedore in a tank top and jeans. The Spaniard shouted in protest and whipped around, knocking Jack aside just as Byakov thrust the poison-filled injector at Jack's face. The spring-fired device dumped a massive dose of nerve agent, Novichok, into the Spaniard's beefy arm. He yelped in painless shock and grabbed his wounded biceps as Jack hammer-fisted Byakov's extended arm, forcing him to drop the lethal cylinder onto the pavement. All of this happened in the span of a couple of heartbeats. The Spaniard's last, it turned out, as the Novichok began its merciless work, killing his nervous system, destroying the connection between his brain and muscle tissues. In 8 more seconds, he'd be dead. Byakov turned and pushed his way back into the oncoming crowd, swimming upriver against the flow of bodies now surging around Brosa, convulsing on the pavement. A young brunette knelt down next to her, feeling for a pulse. Jack glanced back at the Spaniard, who was now crumpling to his knees, his watering eyes wide with terror, bowels and bladder loosed, his breathless mouth open in a silent shout, spilling with vomit. Jack started to reach out for him, but his subconscious told him the Spaniard was beyond help. He turned and chased after Byakov, pushing past the crowd gathering around Brosa's body twisted on the pavement, her now lifeless eyes open to the sky. Jack filed away his grief for later, but not his rage. Powerfully built, the young Russian operative dodged and stutter-stepped around the people he could, and bowled through the ones he couldn't, even tossing a few down behind him to slow Jack's pace. Offended parties reacted to Byakov's rough treatment, but not quickly enough to hurt him, let alone slow him down. In fact, it was Jack who suffered their wrath, as they seemingly blamed him for Byakov's behavior by reaching out with their hands to grab and slow him down. A few threw kicks and punches, but the glancing blows didn't stop him. Jack kept saying, "Lo siento, I'm sorry," to people as he bowled his way behind Byakov, who somehow was threading the needle like a fullback on a broken tackle run and pulling away fast. Jack's only advantage was his height, and he was able to catch a glimpse of Byakov ducking off Laitana and onto an unmarked side street. Jack powered through the surging protesters, ignoring the shouts of anger and fear behind him and the sound of a distant siren. He finally made the turn into the narrow alleyway, but Byakov was gone. Jack slid to a halt. Shit, where did he go? The stone-paved alley bent into a gentle curve, a narrow, shadowed path between 4- and 5-story buildings, leading to a cross street 200 feet ahead. Jack charged forward, eyes scanning recessed doorways and alcoves, racing for the intersection. A glint of steel swung out of the shadows. Jack turned, raising his forearm, blocking the downward strike of Byakov's arm. But Byakov's momentum drove the two of them stumbling across the narrow alley into a niche crowded with garbage cans overflowing with the wet, fetid refuse of a Chinese restaurant. The two of them crashed into the cans, bowling them over. Jack and Byakov fell between them, Byakov on top of Jack, his knees buried into Jack's thighs, pinning him to the filthy pavement. Byakov raised his combat knife with one hand and grabbed Jack's shirt in the other as he plunged the serrated blade at Jack's heart. But Jack snatched up one of the dented garbage can lids and raised it like a shield. The razor-sharp drop-point blade plunged into the aluminum lid up to the hilt, the knife's serrated edges catching in the metal. Jack twisted the lid before Byakov could pull it out, wrenching Byakov's wrist with the torque and toppling him over in the same direction. Jack thrust his hips up and over, using the leverage to accelerate Byakov's fall, tossing him onto the greasy stones. Both men sprang to their feet. Both eyed the blade still stuck in the lid. Jack lunged for it, but wasn't fast enough to avoid the kick to his ribs from Byakov's boot, driving him backward into a wall. Jack grabbed his ribcage as Byakov dove for the knife. The Russian stomped a boot on the lid for leverage and ripped the blade out of the dented metal. He whipped around with the knife, going low and planting his rear foot to spring into a lunge at the big American. As Byakov swept into his turn, Jack's fist plowed into his lower jaw, cracking his teeth. The Russian dropped the knife, stunned. It clattered to the pavement. His face darkened with confusion and then disbelief as he grabbed his jaw with his hand. He glanced up at Jack and flashed a smile at him through gritted teeth. It was a smile Jack had seen before. The big Dutchman, Van Delden, had flashed the same fuck-you smile. The hairs stood on the back of Jack's neck. Byakov's eyes rolled into the back of his head as he tumbled to the ground, his strings cut. Jack knelt down by the corpse, barely hearing the sirens screaming into the alley. Chapter 51, Knoxville, Tennessee. Another late-night marathon in the lab. Nothing new. Parsons seriously considered sleeping on the couch in her office for the next 2 days. Catnaps, anyway. There was a shower in the facility, and even a decent selection of organics stocked in the kitchen pantry. Anything to save time, because time was the one thing she didn't have. Phase one of Tribulation was scheduled to launch in less than 36 hours. The timeline was immutable. So was she. The project had come along nicely, but in this last final stretch, she needed to have her own steady hand on the rudder. They were too close to the end for delegating responsibilities. It was her baby. She was the one who needed to climb into the stirrups and push for all she was worth, no matter the cost. That was a mother's duty, wasn't it? Parsons checked her analog watch again. Security protocols that she had implemented prohibited digital devices of any kind on this level. She sat in the conference room waiting for her Phase 2 division heads to arrive for her first meeting of the evening. The Ukrainian Matvienko headed up the Russian software interface, and his counterpart, the Taiwanese programmer Yu, ran the parallel Chinese effort. These were pioneering software geniuses on the cutting edge of a newly emergent branch of human knowledge. They had made outstanding progress on Phase 2, but there was still so much to do in so little time. She needed a progress report from them, and then, later, the Tribulation Systems engineers. Failure was simply not an option. She picked up her pen and began scribbling notes for the first meeting in her notebook, but stopped. The thought of Dylan Runzo's body shredded like a plate of pulled pork flooding her mind. It was a sudden, violent death that ended the life of one of the most brilliant men she'd ever known. Or fucked. She smiled. The greasy little bastard had it coming. It was too bad. He would have shared in the glory to come, and the money, had he remained true to his loyalties, which at first had been her, and then later Tribulation. Betraying one had betrayed both. That was something she couldn't abide. Dylan needed to be dealt with. She'd made a phone call. It wasn't emotional. It wasn't personal. It was only the simple computational instruction every programmer learned on day one. The most basic of all control flow statements. If, then. This was the most rational and primary means by which the decision to execute a code could be made. Code. Or people. It was simple. Pure. Binary. If a certain condition was true. Guilt. Then the prescribed course of action was taken. If a certain condition were not true, innocence, then the prescribed course of action was not taken. Dylan actually executed himself. He chose his condition when he betrayed Tribulation, or attempted to, and thus his execution was inevitable. Cause and effect, linear and inexorable. But Parsons' new quantum mechanics stood outside of linearity because it was non-localized in either time or space. Israeli scientists had proven that in 2013 when they swapped an entangled pair of temporally separated photons, one future, one past, and detected the polarization of the future photon before the past one was even created. Effect, then cause. Dylan had executed himself the day he decided to betray her. She rubbed her eyes and stretched to push away the failed musings of her amateur philosophizing. It had been a long damn day, and the FBI grilling hadn't improved her mood. She knew she'd passed their oral examination with a decent grade. The only thing that disturbed her was the idea that Dylan's death had been made known so quickly. His true identity was as invisible as a quark to almost everyone on the planet, thanks to the DOE's identity scrubbing program. How he'd been identified so quickly in Spain was troublesome, but not worth her attention at the moment. Security wasn't her department. She'd left that to others. Perhaps that was another reason why she felt no guilt over Dylan's death. There was no blood on her hands. Was there? She saw Matvienko and Yu in deep discussion, heading her way. Her mind snapped into focus. She opened her laptop and pulled up the project management flowchart she'd been using for nearly 2 years. It looked like an underground metro map in the world's largest city, with huge decision nodes like metro stops sprawling across a succession of digital pages. Each decision node was connected by intricate track lines of responsibilities, timelines, and sub-decision points. More than 98% of the chart had been executed and displayed in red. But it was these last few precious stops that led toward the final destination they needed to check off tonight. Judging by the smiles on both men's faces as they stepped into the conference room, those last decision nodes were about to turn red. Hallelujah, as her mother used to say. There was, however, one pubic hair in the organic hummus. Her stomach suddenly sank, as if she were falling off a rooftop. Could these two men be trusted? Could anyone on this project be trusted? Dylan Runzo's betrayal had nearly killed everything she'd worked her whole life to achieve. Tribulation would change the world forever. Dylan's treason was a stunningly selfish act, a betrayal of science itself. She'd thought he was as committed to the project's success as she was, if only because he was as committed to the science as she had always been. Perhaps that was the reason why his betrayal was the black swan event she hadn't predicted or prepared for. What had suddenly frightened her was the obvious and secondary question. Didn't swans usually travel in flocks? Chapter 52, South China Sea. The Vietnam People's Navy patrol boat cut two of its three diesel engines 100 meters out and reduced the third to slow ahead as the skilled helmsman maneuvered it toward the Don Pedro, Guzman's fishing trawler. Guzman was surprised it had taken this long to be pulled over and inspected by one of the national services. He'd passed through the waters of four countries in the last 2 weeks, mostly to take on supplies, gather intelligence, and reinforce the legend that his purse signer ship was indeed a working fishing vessel. It was, at least in part. The Don Pedro's actual captain was a stoic, barrel-chested sailor named Jarpamar, with 20 years' service in Baltic waters as an officer in the Swedish Royal Navy. Jarpamar showed little concern when he was first hailed by the Vietnamese vessel, speaking in English to them through teeth clenched around his perpetually lit meerschaum pipe. After requesting and confirming the Don Pedro's identity from its AIS signal, the Vietnamese captain, Lieutenant Commander Pan, ordered the trawler to stop engines and prepare to be boarded for inspection. Jarpamar complied, readily. The Vietnamese patrol boat was a familiar Russian design that the sturdy Swede had encountered before during his time of military service. Technically, it was half a meter shorter than the Don Pedro, but more than made up for its lack of stature with, among other armaments, a forward-mounted AK-630, a six-barreled 30-millimeter rotary cannon similar to an American M61 Vulcan. Expending upward of 5,000 rounds per minute, the AK-630 could shred the Don Pedro's thin steel plating in a matter of seconds. Compliance was both logical and inevitable.
"We look forward to your visit, Commander," Jarpamar replied.
"We do indeed." The Don Pedro was fishing in international waters, currently undisputed between China and Pan's own country, but close to it. Too close, the Vietnamese captain thought.
The Chinese had been aggressively and illegally overfishing traditional Vietnamese waters for the last 5 years. Worse, the Chinese Maritime Militia, CMM, had become an active and effective arm of the PLA Navy. Drawing on China's huge private fishing fleet, the PLAN had recruited nearly 200,000 civilian fishing vessels. PLAN variously supplied them with advanced electronic equipment, weapons, and training to carry out asymmetrical naval warfare duties. These fishermen soldiers not only illegally fished Vietnamese waters, but harassed other nations' fishing and naval vessels. They also hauled ammunition, weapons, and personnel to various PLAN outposts, and they supported the development of the artificial islands, now permanent and prevalent throughout the South China Sea. The Vietnamese People's Navy, like every other regional navy, had become alarmed by the CMM's activities. It was originally feared that the Don Pedro was one of these vessels in disguise. Pan was ordered to check it out. From his bridge, Pan scanned the deck of the Don Pedro with his binoculars as his patrol boat approached. The blue and white civilian vessel appeared to be a working boat, with cranes and masts to support deep-water commercial fishing. The men on deck were either working or cleaning equipment. They all appeared to be men of fighting age and, it seemed, in good shape, which most deep-water sailors had to be. It was strenuous and dangerous work. None of them appeared to be Chinese. An interesting mix of Europeans, Hispanics, and, he presumed, a few Africans. "Oh," Pan said aloud as his binoculars swept over the front deck. He nudged the naval infantry sergeant standing next to him and handed him the binoculars. "Extreme danger, Sergeant. Better warn your men." The dour infantryman put the glasses to his eyes and scanned the deck, then broke out into a grin. Three young women lay sunbathing on chaise lounges in string bikinis, leaving little to the imagination.
"Perhaps this boarding won't be so bad after all,"
Pan thought, taking back the glasses for a second long look at the young women. 15 minutes later, lines had been secured and the two boats were lashed together, separated only by the Don Pedro's heavy bumpers that squeaked with friction as the two ships bobbed in the gently rolling sea. Lieutenant Commander Pan jumped the short distance between the vessels. He was followed by the sergeant and three more armed naval infantrymen with AK-74 rifles strapped to their chests. Pan and his men were greeted on deck by Captain Yarpheimer, who led Pan and his four men to the Don Pedro's spacious bridge, equipped with the latest navigational equipment. Yarpheimer introduced Guzman as the ship's owner. Guzman offered up a friendly smile, an unopened bottle of Jack Daniel's Black Label, and glasses. Pan's flint-faced demeanor softened slightly at the sight of the Jack Daniels. "No, we can't while on duty, but thank you."
"I understand," Guzman said, cracking open the bottle.
At that moment, two of the statuesque young women Pan had seen sunbathing earlier, one blonde, the other brunette, appeared in the cabin doorway carrying a huge ice chest between them. They were now both dressed in clean coveralls and introduced as the Don Pedro's cooks. Both were taller than the Vietnamese men standing on the bridge. They set the ice chest down on the deck and the blonde opened the lid. Thick slabs of pink tuna steaks and bottles of chilled Filipino Red Horse beer sat on top of the crushed ice. "Japanese sushi chefs say that the southern bluefin is the best tuna for sashimi," Guzman said. "I prefer mine grilled with butter and pepper over a pit barbecue." "What is this?" Pan asked. It was enough food and drink for each member of his crew. "The benefit of being a fishing boat is that we catch a lot of fish. Please accept this small token of our appreciation for keeping the ocean safe and allowing us to do our jobs and feed our families." The commander's eyes fell on the tuna steaks. His mouth watered. "That is very generous of you. But I must inspect your ship."
"We insist on it," Yarpheimer said. "We need your documentation to prove that we are operating legally in these waters, unlike the goddamned Chinese."
Pan's jaw clenched when he heard Chinese. the name of his nation's ancient mortal enemies with whom they'd been warring for 1,000 years. His father had fought against the Americans in what the Vietnamese called the American War. But even his badly wounded father saw the Chinese as far worse enemies of his people than the American invaders, despite the millions of Vietnamese who had perished in that war. Pon nodded his appreciation. "Then I thank you for your generous gift." He turned to his sergeant. "Have your men carry this back to the ship." "Excuse me, sir," the blonde said in accented English, shutting and securing the lid. "But we have a very special way we'd like to prepare the tuna, if you will allow us to do so." The two strong young women picked up the chest with ease. No need for smaller men to do it. Pon exchanged a conspiratorial glance with his sergeant. "We look forward to it," Pon said. "I'll inform our galley that you are on the way." He turned back to his sergeant. "You and two of your men will begin the inspection. The other will escort these ladies to our galley." The sergeant smiled, turned, and barked his orders. The youngest Marine led the way off the bridge with a smile as the two tall women bearing gifts followed behind them toward the stairs. The sergeant and the two other enlisted Marines exited the bridge as well to begin their inspection. Pon turned to Yarphammer. "Your papers, sir." Yarphammer heard the Marine's boots clanging on the steel steps. He pulled a thick leather folio from a nearby desk and handed it to him. Guzman brought over a glass of smoky bourbon to Pon, then handed one to Yarphammer. The Vietnamese officer glanced up, annoyed. "Since we're alone now." Guzman winked. He lifted his glass in a toast. "To the sea, and all that she gives." "Oh, what the hell?" Pon smiled. "To the sea." He threw back his shot. It burned in the best kind of way, warming him all the way down his throat. "Another?" Guzman asked, holding up the bottle. "No, thank you. That is quite enough." "A cigar?" Guzman held out a thick Cuban Cohiba. Pon wavered, then gave in. "Perhaps for later." He accepted the cigar and pocketed it. Guzman reached under Yarphammer's desk and pulled out an unopened box of Cubans and handed it to the commander. "For you and your men, of course. Perhaps after dinner." Pon took the box and tucked it under one camouflaged arm. "The men will enjoy this." He turned serious, suddenly remembering his duty. "Now, shall we proceed to our inspection?" Yarphammer nodded. "Follow me." Yarphammer led Pon and Guzman down the stairs toward the main deck, following the path the Vietnamese Marines took. Guzman saw that the Marines were sniffing around bins and holding tanks, pulling up tarps, checking equipment lockers. Nothing too aggressive, but thorough. His men were disciplined enough to cooperate enthusiastically, even joking with the soldiers as they worked. Yarphammer pointed out the features of his vessel to Pon, his voice booming with pride. He described its speed and endurance characteristics, the amount of fresh fish cargo it could hold in ice thanks to its onboard CO2 refrigeration system, and a host of other nautical features Guzman couldn't care less about. Neither Pon nor his men paid attention to the women following the young Marine as they crossed over to the Vietnamese ship and headed into the bowels of the patrol vessel with their ice chest. "Shall we head below decks so that you can inspect our equipment?" Captain Yarphammer asked. Pon waved the sergeant and his two Marines over to join him, then turned back to the beefy Swede. "Lead the way, Captain." Yarphammer headed down the steel stairs first, followed by the three enlisted men, then Pon, and finally Guzman. The smell of diesel and hydraulic fluid wafted up the staircase as they descended. Yarphammer stopped on the first level and pointed down the hallway. "Crew's quarters." "How many?" 18 souls, all good seafaring men. And women, as you saw." Yarphammer laughed and winked, and gently punched the much smaller Vietnamese. Pon nodded, nearly blushing. Yarphammer pointed to the descending staircase. "This way, gentlemen." Pon led the way,
followed by his men. Guzman and Yarpamer were the last down. The Vietnamese commander heard and smelled the workings of some kind of machine shop, which struck him as somewhat odd. When he reached the lowest deck, he stopped, taken aback by what he saw. His men stood to one side. Yarpamer and Guzman stood close behind them. More fighting-age men and a few women in great physical shape, including the third sunbather he'd seen earlier, were at their respective stations. Some were soldering motherboards, others constructing electronic equipment with fine tools. Still others sat at various computer screens monitoring AIS ship traffic, radar tracks of ships and aircraft, weather patterns, and other data. It looked like a combat information center. In the middle of the room was a 20-foot-long steel table, and lying upon it was something out of a science fiction movie. "What is this?" Pon's last words were choked off by the razor-sharp wire garrote that sliced through his windpipe. Before the other three surprised Marines could react, Yarpamer's knife stabbed with lightning speed, like a needle on the end of a runaway sewing machine. All four men fell into a bloody heap on the rusted steel deck. The men and women working on the floor hardly looked up. Guzman watched Yarpamer wipe the blood off his Fairbairn Sykes fighting knife, a double-edged stiletto designed for surprise attacks, first made famous by the British commandos in World War II. Guzman nodded with an approving smile. "You are fast with that blade, amigo. You should see what my wife can do with it." The big Swede laughed, referring to the brunette cook who was now on the other boat. And definitely not cooking. The tall blonde peeked around the corner of the door into the patrol boat's bridge and called out, "Hello?" The XO stood by the helmsman, trying to reach his commander on the radio. When he heard her voice, he turned around, frowning. The blonde flashed a big toothy smile and came out fully from behind the wall, holding out a bottle of chilled beer with her right hand, her left hand held casually behind her back. "Commander Pon wanted you to have this." She tossed the bottle at the Vietnamese officer. He instinctively reached out and caught it. The bottle exploded in his hands as the frangible 9mm round plowed through it and into his gut. The lead bullet dragged microscopic shards of glass along with it as it shredded his bowels. Two more shots barked out of the blonde's cold, wet pistol as he fell backward. At the same time, 30-45 caliber hollow-point slugs tore around the confined space, ripping into the unprotected flesh of the helmsman and three other crewmen, their eyes wide with shock. The bridge quickly filled with bitter blue gun smoke, the ice-chilled grip of the Heckler & Koch UMP machine pistol clutched in the brunette's hands. She stood just behind the blonde, a wisp of smoke still curling from the crown of her SIG 365 XL pistol. The blonde's ears rang from the deafening noise. She touched her own cheek with the barrel of her SIG, telling the brunette, "You've got a little blood." The brunette reached up and wiped off the arterial spray that had splattered on her face after knifing the young Marine escort and the killing spree below decks that followed. "Call it in," she said to the blonde. The Don Pedro's assault team had boarded the Vietnamese vessel after the first shots rang out in the galley. The assaulters killed the rest of the crew as the women worked their way toward the bridge. The blonde radioed over to Guzman on her comms. She shouted loudly, nearly deaf from the ringing still in her ears. "We're clear. Send the sappers." One of the Don Pedro's assaulters scrambled up behind the brunette, breathing hard, his carbine in hand, his face anxious. "What's the problem?" the brunette asked. "Your man Sablek. He's gone." Later that night, Guzman leaned over the rail on the stern of the ship, smoking one of the fat cohibas, the copper blades of his boat's single propeller frothing the dark water behind them like a ribbon of light. Yarpamer stood next to him with his pipe, nursing a beer, commiserating. "These things happen in war, my friend. He was a good soldier and died doing his duty. That's an epitaph I'll take any day." The Swede took another puff on his pipe. The thin moonlight exaggerated the deep puncture scars in Guzman's round face, making them look like shadowed craters on a brown, fleshy moon. Sablek was just a kid, and we're not at war. He was a second rep para with the Legion, the French Foreign Legion, and tough as nails. He knew what he was getting into when he joined with them, and he knew what he was getting into when he joined with us. He was only 26. Guzman took a long pull on his cigar and exhaled. The blue smoke wafted away into the dark behind them. That's too young to die for money. He didn't die for money. You know that. He died for us, as we would have died for him. Yarpheimer took another swig. We were his family. That means something, doesn't it? Not to his widow. Guzman examined the stub of his cigar, turned up his nose at it, and tossed it overboard. I will see to it she gets a double share for his trouble. That's good of you, Patron. A family takes care of its own. Yarpheimer worried for his boss.
He'd seen these dark moods before in his years as his number three in the Samler organization.
He knew not to try and talk him out of his despair. Still no word from Bykov, Guzman asked. No, sir.
Guzman was now certain that Ryan was connected to Van Delden's death.
Bykov had been sent to kill the big American for that, but he hadn't reported back in. This was worrisome as well. Guzman took the loss of one of his people like it was the loss of one of his own children, of which he had none. But Van Delden's death hit him hardest. The big Dutchman had been Guzman's first European recruit, and a close friend. Did Hart make the AIS swaps? Guzman asked for the second time in the last 10 minutes. The Swede didn't know if his boss was being extra cautious or if he was just distracted by his grief. It wasn't like him to repeat himself. As you ordered. He swapped ours out and put it on the Vietnamese boat and killed their VDR before we scuttled it. The world will think the Don Pedro sank with all hands lost somewhere in the South China Sea. And our new AIS is online and broadcasting. You are now the proud owner of the Lupita under a Panamanian flag. And what did you do with the Vietnamese AIS? Hart decided to put a battery on it and launch it on a weather balloon. At last report, it was traveling due east at 15 knots. A weather balloon? Won't that be a problem? AIS doesn't measure altitude. It's strictly GPS. Longitude and latitude only. He clapped Guzman on the arm as his broad face broke into a wide smile. But it would be funny if the Vietnamese thought their patrol boat was sailing along at 7,000 feet. The Swedish captain swore that a small grin was tugging at Guzman's troubled face, but in the dark it was hard to know for sure. I'm heading for my bunk. Notify me when we reach the next waypoint. Aye, aye, sir. Yarpheimer watched Guzman climb the ladder toward the bridge and his private stateroom. The Swede polished off the last of his beer, then tossed the empty into the churning wake behind him, knowing it would sink eventually, somewhere out in the dark.
October 29th. Chapter 53. Barcelona, Spain. Jack's ankles were cuffed and shackled to the steel chair bolted to the floor. His hands were cuffed and shackled to an iron bracket in the middle of the steel table, its top scratched with graffiti. He wondered if the jailhouse artists got their justice, whatever that was. His wrists hurt where they cuffed him, a little too tight, on purpose, no doubt. Jack had taken a swing at the first cop who approached him in the alley with a drawn gun, not realizing it was a cop. Thank God he only put the man on his ass instead of on an autopsy table. The other cops that swarmed him didn't seem quite as grateful. They rang Jack's bell pretty good, putting him on the ground and cuffing him, even after Jack had surrendered and apologized for hitting the other cop. Jack's ribs still hurt too, where Crooked Nose had kicked him. The image of that fuck you smile looped in Jack's brain like a bad movie trailer. He'd punched him hard, but not hard enough to kill him. Why the smile? But the other image that wouldn't leave his mind's eye was Brosa, dead on the pavement, her lifeless eyes wide to the steel-gray sky. She deserved better. So did her father, wherever he was. It had all happened so fast. He'd replayed the scene in his mind 1,000 times. What could he have done differently? He should have let her lead the way. He should have been more aggressively searching for Crooked Nose after the fight he'd had with him in his parked car. But he never suspected the man would try to kill him and Brosa. Jack assumed he was just a surveillance guy. Had he wanted to kill Jack earlier, he could have done it easily, instead of planting the bugs he never got to use. Brosa's death dragged his soul down even deeper, as Liliana's horrific death clawed at his heart. He'd failed her, too. A hard Spanish face appeared in the steel door's small, wire-reinforced window. The dark eyes scanned the room, then fell on Jack, holding on him for a while.
Maybe the cop wanted to come in there and tune him up while no one else was in there.
If he did, there wasn't a damn thing Jack could do about it. Keys jangled in the lock and the door swung open. Dellinger spoke in Spanish to the guard, who shrugged and shut the door behind the CIA man, then locked it. Dellinger approached the table where Jack was shackled, but remained standing. "Jack, how you doing, son?" Jack raised his shackled wrists a few inches, as far as they could go. "Good thing I don't have to pee." "Well, if you do, don't ask me to hold it for you." "Not part of your cultural affairs responsibilities, I take it?" "No. But getting you out of here is. That's why I called you instead of a lawyer. Speaking of which, didn't you bring one?" "You don't need a lawyer. I've made all the arrangements. A Guardia Civil escort is going to drive you and me straight to the airport and put your ass on a plane to fly you home to Dulles. You can pay for your own damn Uber back to wherever you want to go after that. I'm not going anywhere until this case gets fully and finally resolved." "I guess you're not hearing me. This isn't optional. There are 3 dead people lying in your wake today. 2 Spaniards, including one of their federal officers. They intend to hold you for questioning as a person of interest. And here's the fun part. They're going to hold you without bail for as long as they need, until they wring everything out of you. I didn't do anything wrong. I didn't kill the Spaniards. That other guy did. Which is what you say. Right now there are witnesses that think you were responsible, since you were the one standing closest to both victims. That's ridiculous. That's the nature of eyewitness testimony. Just about the most unreliable kind of testimony there is. But it's out there, and the Spanish authorities have a legal obligation to take it under advisement. And the third guy, the one with the crooked nose." Dellinger leaned on the table like a bad cop. "The one that could have proven you innocent if you hadn't killed him?" "Yeah." Jack smiled. "That one." "As far as I know, smartass, the Spaniards are still trying to identify him. So far, they've come up with at least 7 aliases and 4 nationalities for this joker. The last alias he used was Biekov. And do you know what the real head-scratcher is? I have a feeling I can't stop you from telling me. Turns out, you killed a dead man." "Run that by me again." "Biekov was reported dead 3 years ago. Interpol ran his photo. They think he was an ex-Russian military and ex-Wagner, but they can't be sure. Do you know what Wagner is?" "Russian mercenaries." "You know a lot about the world for a finance guy." "I know how to read a newspaper. I also know that most cultural attachés don't carry." Jack nodded at the shoulder holster underneath Dellinger's sport coat. Dellinger frowned, frustrated that he'd been that careless. He straightened up. "You must throw one hell of a punch, kid, to kill a man with 1 shot to the mouth." "Lucky, I guess." "Well, not for him. Or you. Look, The bottom line is that the Spaniards are very curious and very unhappy with the situation, and the only fall guy they can find within arm's reach is you. I'm not guilty of anything. I'm not worried about what their investigation might turn up. I knew you weren't listening to me. I believe you when you say you had nothing to do with the death of the two Spaniards, and that the death of this Bierkoff character was accidental, because you were just trying to defend yourself, okay? I'm on your side here. Do you believe me or not? Jack nodded reluctantly. Yeah, I guess so. Good, because I am. So please, pay attention. Dellinger pulled on his own ear. And listen to me. You might not be worried about what the Spaniards might turn up on you, but you need to be very worried about how long it will take them to find you innocent. It could be months. It could be years. And if they decide to link you up with the Lavi bombing, that makes you a terror suspect. And then all kinds of new rules and procedures come into play. If the Spaniards think I'm the prime suspect, why are they willing to cut me loose? Because, like the rest of us, they've discovered you're a real pain in the ass. Jack fought back a laugh. That's a title he'd take any day. He'd been a pain in the ass to tangos and shitbirds for years, and he was damn proud of it. Ass pain notwithstanding. You need to be a little more clear. Somehow, this boss of yours, Jerry Hendley, has gotten involved in this, and apparently has a lot of pull with the State Department. You were just about to cause a minor international crisis between our governments, which means a crisis within NATO. And that's something nobody wants. Sounds like I have leverage. Jack wasn't referring to his dad. He would never use his relationship with POTUS for personal advantage, even if that meant getting out of this jail. Dellinger pointed at Jack's handcuffs. Yeah? You got so much leverage. Try standing up right now. Then how come you can get me out of here? Because our two respective governments have worked out a deal, but there's a timestamp on it. If you agree to leave with me right now and let me take you straight to the airport and you return immediately to the States, the Spaniards are willing to accept your version of events. But if I walk out of here today without you, you're on your own. Back alley garbage stink and all. Jack sat back as best he could. He blew out a long sigh, thinking, I just need to know what really happened to Renee Moore. You and I both know what really happened to her. She was killed in an explosion from a bomb detonated by a member of Brigada Catalan. But this Bierkoff guy, he's connected to it too. And if he's ex-Wagner, Bierkoff's dead. You killed him, remember? Case closed. But he was tied to Brigada. Brigada's all dead. Believe me, I know that because I was there when it happened. Case closed. But case fucking closed. Don't you get it? Yeah, I get it. I know it's closed. Laia said the same thing. But there was another American at Lavi who was killed. A guy named Runzo. Dr. Dylan Runzo. Dellinger's face flinched. How do you know about him? He bumped into me as he was coming into the place and I was going out. He said, sorry, man, as we passed. Dellinger's eyes narrowed. Don't you worry about Runzo. And by the way, there were a lot of other people killed and wounded that night. Not just two Americans. Yeah, I know. I was there, remember? One more thing you haven't considered. There's another corpse that's attached to your name, at least by extension. Who? Do you know who Gaspar Peña is? Never heard of him. He was with the CNI, Brosa's boss. They found him a few hours ago, extra crispy. He was handcuffed to the steering wheel of his burned-out Audi R8 Decennium, which is one hell of a car, and about as shitty a way to die as I can think of.
You know I have nothing to do with that.
I know it. You know it.
And wherever the hell Peña is, he knows it too.
But how long will it take the Spanish authorities to figure it out as well? Jack shrugged, Dellinger's logic falling on him like a heavy woolen blanket. So what's it gonna be, Jack? Sit on your ass in a Spanish gray bar hotel for the next 6 months and get your gringo ass mollywopped by local talent until they finally cut you loose? Or do you want to walk out of here a relatively free man and get back to your life in the good old U.S. of A? Jack folded his hands together, rattling the chains, thinking. He knew the moment he left Spain the case really was closed. But he couldn't shake the feeling that there were still a few loose threads that he needed to tug on to get closure. But Dellinger was right. All the cards were stacked against him. The best possible outcome was that he'd waste the next several weeks, if not months, in jail, unable to do any kind of investigative work anyway. The worst case was too terrible to consider. Somehow convicted of one or more killings, even if only by association or intent. False convictions weren't exactly a myth, even in Western democracies. Worse, several weeks in jail, innocent or guilty, meant he'd be off the shelf as far as the campus was concerned. And for what? The case really was closed. Rene's killers were dead. So were Brosas. And knowing his father, there wasn't any chance he wouldn't get involved at some point to get his oldest son out of the hoosegow, especially if he was innocent. If POTUS got involved, that surely meant his identity as the son of swordsman would be revealed. That would definitely kill his future as an undercover operative with the campus. Okay, you win. Let's get the hell out of Dodge. Dellinger grinned. Smart boy. He pounded on the steel door with the open palm of his hand, telling the guard to let them out. In a few hours, Jack would be somewhere over the Atlantic, far from Spain. A free man. Chapter 54. True to his word, Dellinger got Jack out of jail almost as fast as he could walk him through the front doors and into the fresh air and sunshine. An unmarked Guardia Civil Nissan SUV stood at the curb with the rear door opened. The international business intern Jack had spooked earlier stood by it holding Jack's leather satchel, stuffed with his clothes and his laptop bag. "Who told you you could break into my place?" Jack said, still reeking and disheveled like a man who'd just broken out of a dumpster. The college-age kid blanched at Jack's tone and pointed at Dellinger. "He sent me." "We didn't have time to waste," Dellinger said, motioning for Jack to get in the car as the Guardia Civil plainclothes detective climbed into the driver's seat. "How'd you know I'd take your offer?" "Because I figured you weren't stupid. Get in. We're late for your flight." Jack snagged his satchel and laptop from the intern and fell into the back seat next to Dellinger. They slammed the doors behind them as the Nissan rocketed toward the airport. Dellinger and the Guardia Civil detective driver both escorted Jack into the giant glass and steel Barcelona El Prat airport southwest of the city. Thanks to his Spanish escort, Jack and Dellinger were both passed through to the front of the long check-in and security lines. Their movements were tracked by the angry, jealous eyes of the passengers lined up like cattle in pens waiting for slaughter. Jack was then led to his departure gate and ushered to the gate agent's desk. The agent was forced to reopen the jetway when the detective flashed his badge, though it was against company policy to do so. Dellinger offered Jack a firm hand that was as much a warning as a pleasantry, along with, "Good luck, son," before Jack disappeared into the jetway. The Spanish detective escorted Jack to his seat, turning curious heads as they strode through the wide first-class aisles and back to the narrow ones in coach. Jack stuffed his carry-on into the crowded overhead and shoved his laptop under the seat in front of him. He then fell into his chair and buckled in. The detective flashed Jack one last angry glance before he turned around and marched back off the plane. The middle-aged flight attendant for Jack's section was a real pro. She hid her concern over Jack, unlike the passengers near him, who squirmed uncomfortably in their narrow seats, trying desperately not to look at, or smell, the large bearded man suddenly thrust into their presence by a police escort. Jack perused the drink card, searching for something hard. It was going to be a long damn flight. After 3 glasses of Jameson Irish whiskey, Jack was finally numb to his frustration and grief. He felt like shit that Brosa had died, but at least he'd killed the asswipe that did it. How he killed the man with a single punch to the face still confused him. According to Dellinger, the Spaniards would get around to an autopsy in the next few weeks, and he promised to let Jack know what the results were, as if that was some sort of consolation over Bjorkov's death. It wasn't. Jack didn't need any. Now, winging his way back home, Jack was leaving both physically and emotionally drained. Renee was dead, and nothing would change that. But at least the people who claimed responsibility for her death were all dead, along with the man Jack believed to be the real bomber, even if he wasn't with Brigada Catalan. He hated to admit it, but the case really was closed. It felt like a betrayal of Renee, and especially Brosa, but he had done everything he could in the short time he had. His heavy eyelids began to flutter. He reclined his seat as far as it would go, and gave in to the sleep that had eluded him for the last 24 hours. Maybe it was the booze, or something else that fueled his dream. But Jack found himself back inside Lavi. This time the crowded restaurant was full of street protesters jammed in so close that Jack could hardly breathe. He fought his way toward the exit, desperate to escape the suffocating mass of flesh. Just as he reached the cool, fresh air pouring in at the doorway, he bumped into a long-haired Runzo. Only this time, it was Jack who said, "Sorry, man," instead of the shorter, hapless man. Runzo said nothing, but only stared for a long moment at Jack with eyes full of unspeakable sadness. Then finally he turned away, trudging in slow motion, not into a crowded restaurant, but instead into a shrieking wall of fire, his body vaporizing in flames so hot that it made Jack's skin tingle. Chapter 55, Knoxville, Tennessee. Parsons was beside herself. She rubbed her bare arms, her skin literally tingling with anticipation. In 11 hours and 48 minutes, she would make history. She couldn't stop smiling. She felt like the yearning, libidinous gymnast she'd once been, waiting by her locker for the high school quarterback to whisk her away in his cherry-red Camaro. She blushed at the memory. That was a hell of a good day, too. The last staff meeting had just concluded. All of the department heads showed up, eager and grinning. Always a good sign. Every department reported in as ready. Each division head guaranteed that every hardware and software system had been stress-tested and double-checked, and that all personnel were ready and in place. Everything had gone according to plan. Everything was on schedule. To hell with rapture. Tribulation was about to change the world. And to hell with you, Dr. David Rhodes. You worthless, back-slapping, glad-handing, thieving prick, Parsons said in a quiet whisper. Rhodes took rapture from her. He had talent enough for that. His soft, manicured hands were strong enough to stab her in the back and twist the knife. He'd stolen all the credit for her work, her genius. He'd stolen her baby. Sure. It was just another case of politics and patriarchy biting her in the ass again. But it was his name that would have gone down in the history books. Would have. She laughed to herself. But nobody remembers second place. That's just first place for losers.
Rapture wouldn't be first. Tribulation would have that honor. She would have that honor. And Rhodes would be standing around with his tiny dick in his even tinier fingers, wondering how she had stolen it from him. Parsons crossed over to the Viking refrigerator in the break room and pulled out a cold Fiji water, savoring her moment to come. Rhodes would look like the biggest idiot in the world, the ultimate dupe, the completely clueless chucklehead that let a woman kick him in his diminutive nutsack. She cracked open the bottle and took a long pull of cold, clear water. And to think, she'd nearly walked away from it all. "You'll never make a good decision while you're angry," her Sunday school teacher mother had always said. For once, the old bag had been right. Parsons was practically out the door, already circulating her incredible CV, when the call came that changed her life. She could hardly believe it. At first, she thought it was a test. Maybe even a trap laid out by the feds. It wasn't. It took some time for him to prove himself and to earn her trust. But he did. He proved that he had the funding. He showed her that he was risking as much as she was, if not more. He certainly had the motivation. And he had a plan. A hell of a plan. But most important of all, he believed in her. He told her how significant she was, and he wasn't just blowing blue smoke up her skirt. He'd followed her research and knew about Rapture, and all about Rhodes, and how he had played the Jacob to her Esau and stolen her birthright. How he'd known about all of it, she could never figure out. But that just spoke to her about the power of his reach and his incredible resources. Her patron clearly understood her contributions to the work. He was no scientist, but possessed an impressive command of the subject for a civilian. He told her how her name would rank in the pantheon of all great scientists, not just women scientists, but all scientists. He appealed to her vanity, no doubt, and she was vain. Except it wasn't vanity, because what she believed about herself was absolutely true. And it was. She was a genius. So, she finally agreed to the plan. He would build an alternate facility, not too close to Oak Ridge, but not so far away that she couldn't be there on a regular basis to oversee the work. He would provide a list of vetted scientists, programmers, and engineers, but she would have the authority to hire and fire them. He would provide all of the security, and all of the materials, and all of the resources needed. All she ever needed to do was send him her list of needs, human or material, and he would provide it. Her contributions were materially minimal, but the most significant. She would continue to plow ahead at Oak Ridge and push the Rapture project forward, extracting every ounce of information and insight from it that she could, and then bringing it over to the Tribulation program. Of course, there were certain expectations he put upon her, but they were reasonable, given the outcome. First, he told her, Tribulation must be completed and ready to deploy on a certain date and time, no exceptions. He named both. Do you agree? Of course. And you believe it's absolutely possible? I do. Are you willing to bet your life on it? I am. Then you just did. The threat was neither unexpected nor particularly frightening. It also showed that he was serious, which she admired. Parsons was certain she'd meet the deadline, as certain as she was the sun would rise in the morning, or that energy could be neither created nor destroyed. She expected to get paid something at some point, but was surprised that $30 million had already been deposited into an encrypted account for her,
This was immediately available for transfer to another account of her own choosing, and in any denomination or medium of currency she preferred. If, for whatever reason, he decided to cancel the project, she would keep the money without condition. It was also expected that she would say nothing about Tribulation to anyone outside of the lab where it was being built. After Tribulation was launched, she still couldn't reveal her involvement for exactly 365 days. Why?
For your protection and mine. Time to allow us to find places to hide in the world where we can never be found.
She didn't question it further.
A year wasn't much of a delay in relation to the fame that would accrue to her forever afterward.
Her brilliance would be her defense if she decided to come back into the world. And if she decided to remain in hiding? Well, she wasn't looking for celebrity anyway. Only the universal acknowledgement that she had won. And Tribulation would prove that.
The final expectation was that she would carefully and surreptitiously sabotage progress on the government's Rapture project. The reason was obvious. The only possible threat Tribulation faced would be the launch of Rapture, the only other true universal quantum machine on the planet. But what utterly delighted her was the fact that Rhodes's reputation would be ruined.
Tribulation would change the world because nearly every form of modern military and civilian operations, intelligence gathering, information processing, and communications all relied heavily, if not exclusively, on digital data. All of that data was